From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Canadian philosopher Marshall McLuhan is known for his analysis of how mass media and technology shape human consciousness and society. He coined the term global village in the early 1960s, referring to how electronic media would collapse space and time barriers in ways it was impossible to predict. McLuhan argued that the way we communicate is more influential than the content of the communication itself. He's most famous for the expression, "the medium is the message," which means the technology or medium we use to transmit information changes our behavior more than the information it carries. Tim Love spent more than four decades in the world of advertising. He was vice chairman of the global advertising and marketing services company Omnicom Group, and when he retired in 2013, he was CEO of Omnicom's Asia Pacific, India, Middle East, and Africa regions. Since retiring, Love has turned his attention toward the way our online world operates today and how behavior data collected on us users is being used to not only drive our behavior, but is negatively impacting mental health and has led to polarization. His 2022 book, Discovering Truth, How to Navigate Between Fact and Fiction in an Overwhelming Social Media World, explores these ideas, and now his brand new book, the title of which alludes to Marshall McLuhan's work, further refines his views on how our open, unregulated internet and social media platforms are reshaping our relationships, our politics, and our sacred beliefs. The Medium is the Mirror, The Reformation of Truth, was published last month. I spoke with him about it yesterday and a local pastor who wrote one of the chapters titled When Theology Meets Algorithm. Let's hear that conversation now. Tim Love is author of The Medium is the Mirror, The Reformation of Truth, Reshaping Our Relationships, Politics, and Sacred Beliefs. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And Reverend Dr. Dan Lamy is founding pastor of Jubilee Fellowship of Naples. He wrote one of the chapters of Tim's new book. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks. So good to be with you.
So, Tim, we're going to start right with you. The title, explain it. So listeners will probably at least be somewhat familiar with the term, the medium is the message, which was coined by Marshall McLuhan.
Right.
This is clearly a riffing off of it. Connect those dots.
Well, medium is the message by McLuhan tried to get us to pay attention to where we get our information, and that where we get our information has an effect on us, whether it's print, radio, television, and now the computer, now the internet. The medium is the mirror is really intended to be an interruption for people, because I believe that the way that the internet works today is it's reading what our interests and the words we use when we use the internet, and then it's directing more information to us based on our interests. So from that standpoint, what you see on the internet, and you have to be aware of this, whether it's just emails or you don't have to be on a social media site. If you're using email, you're getting information that's geared to your preconceived beliefs, and therefore you're looking in a mirror at yourself.
It's like if when TV first came out, it was one thing to disrupt how we got information, but it'd be another thing if we all turned on the TV and we all saw something different every single day, like back in the 50s. That would be the analogy, I guess.
Mm. Yep.
There was a quote that you pulled from McLuhan, which I found excellent. I'd never heard this before, and it really crystallizes what he said for me. The content of a medium is like the juicy piece of meat carried by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind, meaning that it's not necessarily what's coming to us in that back and forth interactive way. It's the fact that the back and forth interactive thing is even happening. Is that correct?
Yes. And, you know, I spent my career in advertising, and I had to learn a fair amount about persuasion. And that particular quote is very good, because it forces you to think about, how do I get their attention? How do I sustain their attention? And there is distraction involved, because you're trying to get somebody to pay attention to you. And this has never been more profoundly controlling than it is with the internet and emails and social media today. Television didn't even do it the way that this does.
I've had you on the show several times before, which we'll link to on the web post for this show, where we get more further into a lot of the other stuff. But this book is in part a distillation of the things that we've talked about. I've distilled it down to some key ingredients. Okay. I'm going to throw them out there, and we may pause on one because it's going to be novel to a lot of people. Key ingredient number one, how the internet and by extension social media platforms are regulated or not regulated under a law passed back in 1996 and a section of it called Section 230, ingredient one. The fact that social media platforms make their money by advertising but aren't required to ensure that the products being sold aren't harmful. This is the one that people will find novel. The way expressing ourselves with words non-verbally has a psychological impact. Can you explain what that means?
Yes. This all really started to change when we went to being able to put like, share, and retweet, because these were measures of actual behavior. There were physical behaviors of pushing a button and making a decision. And that was something that didn't really exist with any medium prior to this, unless it was a coupon and you wrote it down and sent it in for, you know, free package of Xenia seeds or something like that. This one was a measure that allowed advertisers and the internet to gauge what are your interests, because you pushed a button and clicked, which expressed interest, or you shared it with somebody. And they could also read how long you spent looking at that page. So it was a very, very significant change in terms of a medium. And back to what McLuhan said about distraction, and you could read the distraction, you could bet on it. And advertisers started moving towards this data, because the data could all be done by machine learning, by computer. You didn't have to have two people sitting down there reviewing research. And it was the use of AI. AI has been long used, and it was a big part of AI's impact on us. It's talked about now like it's something new. It isn't really new. It's going to a fifth dimension, but the AI has always been a very key part of this since like 2007, 2008.
You also write about how there's research that shows if you write something down, it locks you into that in some small way, and that can compound over time. So the fact that we're all using text, emails, social media posts, we're clicking, we're writing words, that has a it locks you into a perspective, sort of.
Yes. It's called commitment consistency. Commitment consistency is a very strong psychological dynamic that's used in persuasion. The way I suggest your listeners think about this is you probably had Ford families or Chevrolet families who got into a routine of being loyal to a brand. And commitment consistency leverages that by finding out what your commitments have been in the past, because the feeling is you either have to disrupt those commitments and that consistency, or follow through with it and say this is another Ford and another Chevrolet or whatever. But it's very important that people understand that when you write something down, you're using different parts of your brain than you are when we're talking face-to-face. Certainly when we're talking face-to-face, I'm reading eye contact, I'm reading flushing of your skin, I'm reading your head turn, I'm reading whether you're paying attention. And I'm also reading whether I understand what you're saying. But when you're writing, it's called asynchronous communication, which means that it takes place sequentially. It's like writing your aunt. You write your aunt, you wait a couple weeks, she writes you back. But when you're doing this with the immediacy of the internet and typing and texting, you're making commitments and decisions that are profoundly locked into your psyche. People, once they make a decision, once all of us do this, this isn't just, it's common human behavior. When we make a commitment, we stick to it, and we look for information that confirms those decisions rather than information that makes us rethink those decisions. And so what we have with the internet that's different than any other medium prior to this is we have a brainwashing mechanism that we're participating in on ourselves.
And it wasn't designed to be that. It just turned out that the medium that we chose, the way it works with human psychology, leaves us susceptible.
The reason it evolved to the way it has is because when the internet first started to become practical in America, which is around 1995, 96, it was about 15% of adults were able to get on the internet. And for your listeners, they'll remember the sound of getting online and that they had to get a modem and they had to put it into a telephone line. So the imprint that the internet had on us was that it was somehow related to telephone service. And because we had had such a race for the atom bomb and such a race for space and were so disappointed when America wasn't first in space when in 1956 when the Sputnik went up, we swore we'd never get behind in any technology again. So it made sense when we were the first to start to make the internet practical and people could use it for email and messaging and information, that they would, the government would look at it and ask, what can we do? It's very similar to right now, where there's a lot of talk about AI and whether there should be regulations and, boy, what is it going to do to us? And, oh, boy, it's dangerous. Oh, boy, it's great. It was very, very similar in 1995. So they sat down with the platforms and they said, we don't want to get in your way. We want you to develop and maintain leadership. The rest of the world was barely on the internet. It was less than 1%. And they said, the platforms, they said, well, what can we do? And they said, well, don't have any regulations. The same thing they're saying with AI. And the government said, well, what's your business model? How are you going to grow? And they said, we're going to grow on subscriptions like telephone service. What about advertising? All other media in America, it's been a key feature of our strength in media worldwide, is that it's advertising driven and it makes it easier for people to get and to use. And they said, no, we're not going to use advertising. Our business model is going to be subscriptions.
And we all know how that turned out.
Well, then they went to the big advertisers and asked them. And
yeah.
I happened to be working with the big advertisers at the time. I saw what was happening with the internet with my children and how I was using it for business. I was living in Belgium doing a global job, and it was very important to me. And I went to the big advertisers and said, shouldn't we be looking at this? And they said, no. And I said, why? And they said, because the screen's too small.
Hmm.
That was almost 12 years before the iPhone. The reason they said the screen was too small is they were looking at a computer screen that was like a word processor. And what a lot of the listeners need to remember is what that looked like. And what that looked like in 1995, 96 was all type, no color, no sound, no videos. And, of course, it would be believable that you might not use that for advertising. The other reason the advertisers said that was they knew where the television industry was heading from an engineering standpoint. The television engineers told them, we're going to major flat screens, high-definition television, and it's going to happen really soon. And so they didn't want their agency, advertising agency people, taking their eye off of video and commercials. They wanted us to get better at it and to move money out of print and radio into television. They didn't want us trying to work with the internet at such an infant stage. And somebody in the mix of that discussion said, well, we've had issues with other media in America. Every time a new media comes along, there's abuses. And those abuses tend to show up in two ways, child pornography and human trafficking. What will you do about that, platforms? And they said, well, we'll operate on a good faith basis. And so they set up Section 230 because the platform said, if I take something down, I don't want to be sued by the person or the company or whoever posted it. So they put in an exemption in Section 230. It's only 26 words. And it's called the Good Samaritan Clause because they're going to operate like Good Samaritans and take stuff down that's harmful. And that hasn't been the case because the incentive isn't to do that. The incentive is to do everything in their power to get your attention sustain that attention, and that's how the algorithms got developed. They developed for profit, not for safety.
The fourth key ingredient I've pulled is the open nature of our internet leaves us open to exploitation by anyone on the planet with an internet connection.
This mystifies me, because when I talk about this with people, they look at me and it's like, well, they're not going to do anything about it and they're not sure they believe me. I was in Asia working with the largest advertisers in the world, and we were launching in China and Russia and all the places, 120 different countries. So I know a little bit about this. And what happened was, after the 2008 Olympics, when China came out and was such a big, wonderful thing, all the advertisers ran to advertise in China. Many had already been there. And the platforms said, okay, we're going to go into China and Russia. And they asked us, how did they do that? How did they call on China and Russia, and what were the best practices? And we told them who, you know, which division and which administration and so forth. And they went over and they had their presentations, and they came back and the Chinese said, you're not coming in here. We're not allowing you to come in. And our platforms decided at that point that China couldn't do this on their own, that they'd have to be part of our World Wide Web, or they wouldn't be part of a World Wide Web. So because they weren't losing business, they said, we'll wait them out. And what we did instead was start introducing in other countries like Indonesia. Well, Indonesia is now the third largest Facebook country in the world. People go, well, how did that happen? Well, it's because that region around Indonesia has a bigger population than America, and the median age in Indonesia is 24, like it was in America in the 1960s. So this was a very high conversion, very popular market in which the platforms could very easily launch. But the problem was, sometimes American business, and I've seen this and fallen prey to it myself, can be a bit arrogant. And this feeling that they would have to be part of our internet to be on the internet was that arrogance. And what happened was, we've left ours wide open for them. When people talk about TikTok and they're worried about TikTok because it's owned by the Chinese, I said, you should worry about every single one of the platforms, because China, Russia, Iran, you name it, has access to our internet, and they can talk directly to you. You don't know where the information's coming from.
X, formerly Twitter, just turned on a program that allows people to see where they're from. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the biggest, like, influencers on political issues that are contentious that claim to be Americans were from, like, Pakistan.
Right.
I mean, that's not a conspiracy theory.
No.
They turned on the feature, and so everyone could see.
No. And I guess when you think about it, we certainly know a lot about what Voice of America did during World War II in terms of trying to bring truth to the world about the status of the war. Unfortunately, the Voice of America has been greatly minimized by our current administration, which is a shame to me, because people aren't hearing from America. But China didn't want us talking directly to their people. It's that simple, okay? Yet we left ours wide open for them to talk directly to our people. And
we gave them the ability to do it in a masked way, so we don't know it's them.
Right. Now, I've known that this is true since 2018, when I interviewed a gentleman from Facebook. And I had promised that I wouldn't give him a hard time, and that I wanted him to decide what the questions were. I wanted his corporate communication people to be on the podcast. And during the podcast, he volunteered. I didn't ask him that during the 2016 election, they knew that their platform was used by Cambridge Analytica, and that was illegal because they hadn't paid for it. He also went on to say that the Internet Research Agency of St. Petersburg, Russia, used their platform during the 2016 election. The people that were listening to this, their mouths dropped, because our administration at the time was saying, oh, absolutely no interference. It was some fat guy on the edge of a bed. It's not true. And a lot of people believed that. But what really kind of got me about this is after I had the podcast, I said to the guy, can you tell where the content comes from? And he said, oh, yeah, we know where it comes from. Well, why didn't they tell us? Why didn't they do anything about that? Because they're leaning on Section 230 and they don't want to lose it. It's a moneymaker for them. It's time to change Section 230. It's dangerous to our children and it's dangerous to our country.
Dan, I want to bring you in now. You are founding pastor of Jubilee Fellowship of Naples. How did you get involved with this book? How do you know Tim?
Tim and I met through a men's discussion group initially. I believe that he had kind of come in and out from about 2015 when he moved down here. I have a number of men's discussion groups that I lead at different country clubs in the Naples, greater Naples area, where we try to tackle some of the bigger issues so that we can make sure that as life confronts us, that we can have honest discussion, that it's not about who's right and who's wrong, but what happens when we wrestle with this disorientation in relationship? And how do we deal with that? And I just think that what we've lacked a great deal in all of our discussion is a civility and a willingness to listen with integrity, not to respond, but to understand. And for me, theologically, it goes back to St. Francis of Assisi. So when we were having some of these discussions in our group at Imperial, Tim was bringing some of the things that he knew and understood, and I remember being very alarmed as I listened to the information that he was sharing. So I always go back and do my own homework. I'm an original source sort of person, so I went back and started doing some of my own work, and I thought, he's onto something here, and I have great, great concern about my children and my grandchildren and the effect of the internet unbridled on our society as a whole. So I was very grateful to run into him, and he invited me in to the project, and I was really excited about the opportunity.
What changes or what kinds of changes have you seen in the way churches are interacting with the people who are coming to their churches and how the people are interacting with the churches? Like on each side of that coin, how has social media, the polarized world that we've wound up in because of it, how is that all interacting with churches and churchgoers?
I think churchgoers from their side of the pew are seeking to find some sense of an answer, understanding to life's difficult questions when they cannot make sense out of the nonsense that they're experiencing. And let's just take something as simple as the economy. One side would tell you that we're in great shape. Another side will tell you that you're not in very good shape. And depending upon where you are, you may have two separate realities, which I think are both true, but that prohibits us from having a conversation about how do we solve the particular problem for different peoples that are at different strata versus we come up with a monolithic answer of this is right and this is wrong. And so I think the church is in a very difficult space when truth is always questioned. How do we know what we're hearing is true? How do we know what we're reading is true? How do we know that what the pastor is saying from the pulpit is true? And so the very essence of what's going on is there's this erosion that is occurring on what we can stand on, what we can really bank on. And I think within the church itself, they've tried several things. I know of several churches, new church developments, that are using the internet in a positive way where they're creating apps, kind of affinity apps. Do you like this? What is this a question you have about maybe some particular concern emotionally, psychologically, anxiety, all of that. And then they'll just gather those people together in a spot that they kind of send out the app. They get everybody connected. They start to do some work with them. They'll bring them together. And that's kind of the beginning of a community to have conversation. And I think that's a really positive use of that. The downside of the internet with regard to what's going on in the life of the church is not necessarily about the connectivity. It's about the substance of the information that's coming in and the constant work you have to do with people with regard to critical thinking. And you've probably seen that even in your own experience. If the Pope speaks with great authority, there's a whole group of people who are going to follow that authority because it's rooted in tradition, it's rooted in their history, it's rooted in their spirituality, it's rooted in their commitments. But what's happened in our world today is there's no place to go that we can hold on to. And I think the church has a great opportunity right now to step into this space as Tim has shared with us, to protect our children, to protect our society as a whole from nefarious actors that would actually use the internet to influence such things as our elections, and even our understanding, basic understandings of what a constitutional republic looks like.
You write, "Are we building tools that serve us or idols that rule us?" And I quote that to, you know, get to the faith in God, faith in great tradition, faith in spirituality. Is that being disrupted by this place that we found ourselves?
Yes, and I think the reduction sauce of that, the crystallization of all of that, is that when push comes to shove, people have to ask honest questions about who am I and what's required of me. With the internet usage and the things that Tim was talking about, the likes that happen, the dopamine that occurs as a result of people getting liked, it moves us almost to what I would describe as adolescent behavior, where everything I do and I say needs to be affirmed and confirmed. Spiritual adulthood is about not needing that outside validation from anyone else, other than knowing that you're in a relationship with a God who's a loving source. There are lots of different religious structures. There's lots of different types of communities, but most of them hold in common that there is something greater than the self that calls us to a higher understanding of the self. And the internet seems to work with our basest understandings of the self and manipulates us in ways that we're not even aware of. And that's why I'm grateful to have met Tim, because he doesn't present himself as one sounding alarms, but in his writing and in his commitment, there's a great alarm that's being sounded.
As I said, I've talked to you a number of times, Tim, and I keep track of this world on my own terms, but this book really does distill it in a very accessible way. So I hope lots of people read it.
I hope so, but I feel like this continuum that I've been working on, I've started telling people that the intention of this book is to be an intervention. It's to get people to stop and consider their belief mechanics and the beliefs they have. And sometimes I find that it's just really hard because these are unseen influences. For example, I like to ask people who tell me, "I don't understand how I'm being influenced and how this writing thing works that you're talking about." And I'll say, "Well, do you remember when you first heard that Barack Obama doesn't have a birth certificate, that he's not American?" Most people don't remember precisely when that happened, but the research says that the likelihood is that they heard it from a friend in an email sending them an article or a blurb that they heard about on the news. And so when you receive something in writing over the internet, the mere fact that you're reading it makes it more real. Do you understand? It's different if I'm sitting across from you and you say something. I can choose to not believe what you're saying, and I have the opportunity to ask you and challenge you, "Well, where did you get that information? How did that happen?" But if it shows up and I print it out and I'm looking at it in my hand, that means that the event of the question is real. And some people used that for 5 years after he presented his birth certificate. And there's people in our country that still don't believe that he has a birth certificate. And that's not a political thing. That's because I want people to understand it works on every dimension of whatever your belief system is. The way that they influenced our prisoners of war during the Korean War was through a Chinese method of belief change that used getting the soldiers to write things down in seemingly innocuous, not important, or dangerous ways, but slowly but surely moving their belief system. And that, I'm telling you, is what we're experiencing here. The evidence of it is to reflect on how you learn about things. The evidence of it is to also look at how polarized we are. There isn't too many people I know that won't tell me that we're not polarized.
Something Dan said earlier, I started saying on this show in certain times and places about 4 years ago, it's almost like we've wound up in two realities without a Venn diagram, even where they overlap a little bit. And that was like 4 years ago. And we are certainly less Venn diagrammed now than we were 4 years ago.
Right. And that's, you said a key word. What happens is our reality is based, our definition of reality or truth is based on the information that we use and the validity of that information. And we have a choice. We can decide whether it's true or not. Some people said to me when I started this that, you know, there's got to be some things that are true, Tim, no matter what. And I said, like what? This was one of the people in my podcast. And he said, well, I think that everybody's got to pay taxes and everybody's going to die. And I said, well, I don't want to be argumentative with you, but not everybody pays taxes. And number two, there isn't a religion on the planet that doesn't promise that there's life after death.
Yeah.
So your decision about death is your decision. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that I think a lot of people think that this foreign information that they're going to see will be very easily detected, that it's going to somehow have an accent or somehow look foreign. No, they're smarter than that. This is warfare. It's information warfare. And we have to wake up. We have to wake up and unify and do something about our restrictions on the internet. And people say, well, Tim, you're talking about regulations. And I'm not big on regulations, but I am on collaboration. I'm talking about collaboration to have communication policy reform. Okay, I didn't use the word regulation. And we've done this before in television. Don't you think we had troubles in the early days of television and during McCarthyism? Does anybody remember the Fairness Doctrine that started in 1949 and most of my generation grew up with? You know, they think, well, you know, Walter Cronkite was an honest guy and we trusted him. Well, he had to follow the Fairness Doctrine. He had to look at both sides of the story. We walked away from the Fairness Doctrine in 1987, right on the beginning of the internet. And so there's no other side other than the one you want to advocate and draw people into and get them to stay riveted to. And that polarizes people. That's the strategy our enemies use to disrupt us, because when we're polarized, we're paralyzed. Last thing I want to say about communication policy reform. There is an act called the Kids Online Safety Act that was proposed in Congress in 2024. So it was the 118th Congress. In July of 2024, a little over a year and a half ago, it passed 91-3 in the Senate. We haven't had anything pass like that in America, but it passed 91-3. And it then got turned over to the House. And of course, the House took a vacation. And the House never put it before the floor of the House. Why? Because we have more control of our information in this country than we've ever had in our history. 7 to 10 companies control all the information.
That was my last key ingredient. And, people
don't realize the power they have. It's bigger than the automotive industry. It's bigger than the fossil fuel industry. It's bigger than the guns and ammo industry, pharmaceutical industry, and packaged goods. They are so powerful that they are controlling our government. And all I ask you to do is look at the inauguration and the 7 guys sitting on the front of the dais. What was that all about? Well, they all made money because they didn't want the Kids Online Safety Act to pass, because it would have meant that they would have had to start monitoring. And they can monitor with AI. They can do this. It's not about perfection. It's about making a consequence for harmful content.
We are basically out of time. And I don't know if you'd be willing to do this, Dan, but in the end of your chapter, you asked ChatGPT to write something, and I would like you to read it, because it's kind of exemplifying of the double-edged sword, because I found it to be pretty sharp, but it's also representative of our trust in things that we don't understand. So read it if you wouldn't mind.
I will, and I'm assuming that you're talking about the prayer right at the very end.
Yep.
Because I, having worked on this, I wanted to make sure that ChatGPT at least had an understanding of what I was framing and how I was trying to frame things. And I just gave it some basic instructions and asked it if it would just put together a prayer of reflection. Because I do think reflection is incredibly important as part of any process with an internet that works instantaneously. And I think we're lacking that capacity. So I asked for this prayer, and I share it with you now. A prayer of reflection for truth and wisdom in a digital age. God of all wisdom, in a world where truth is traded for trends and attention is bought and sold, truth teaches us to be seekers of what is real and lovers of what is good. Grant us the patience to pause, the courage to question, and the humility to admit when we have been misled. May our algorithms be guided not by greed, but by justice, compassion, and mercy. And may our hearts, amidst the digital noise, still hear the whisper of your voice. Amen.
Amen.
Reverend Dr. Dan Lamy is founding pastor of Jubilee Fellowship of Naples and the author of Chapter 7 of Tim's book. Thank you for your time, Dan.
Thank you so much. It's a joy to be here.
And Tim Love is author of The Medium is the Mirror. It's been good talking to you again, Tim.
Thank you, Mike.